This is where we live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Long before modern highways, there was an extensive network of Native American trails up and down the East Coast. Coming up, we'll learn about efforts in North Carolina to map old Cherokee trails. But first, the Civilian Conservation Corps. You've most likely heard of this group, or at least noticed their work at a state park or trail. The Great Depression-era work crew lasted almost 10 years under President Franklin D. Roosevelt. East Hampton resident and author Marty Potscotch has written a book about the Connecticut men who worked in the program at a time when it was difficult to find a job. Have you thought about the work of the Civilian Conservation Corps when you're outdoors? Did you have a family member who worked in the CCC? We want to hear from you. Email wherewelive at WMPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. I want to welcome into the studio Marty Potscotch, again, a historian, an East Hampton resident, and author of his latest book, Connecticut Civilian Conservation Corps Camps, History, Memories, and Legacy of the CCC. Marty, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
How did you get involved in all of this?
I first got involved with the Civilian Conservation Corps when I was doing research on books about the Adirondack fire towers. And somebody had some pictures about the CCC boys working in the Adirondacks. So after I finished a book on the Catskills and two volumes on the northern and southern fire towers of the Adirondacks, I decided I was going to go from the men and women who were up in the fire tower watching for smoke and trying to slow down the fires or put out the fires to now the men who built up our forests during the 1930s.
Now, I mentioned the CCC was part of the New Deal program under President Roosevelt. You're a historian. Tell us again, what was the thrust of this program and how easily was it created back in 1933?
It was easily done because he did have control of both the House and the Senate, and he proposed it on March 27th to both the House and the Senate, and 4 days later it passed both the House and the Senate. And it was one of the many alphabet programs that he proposed to Congress and Senate and that were passed very quickly. And he told Congress, I want 250,000 boys working in our state forests, national parks, by July 1st, and he chose the Army to be able to provide food, clothing, and shelter to these young boys, and he had the Department of Labor check to see what families in each of the towns and the states that needed help that were on relief. Most of these boys, too, had to quit school, most of them by eighth grade, because they had to find money to help their parents. Many of their fathers either were out of work completely or maybe one day a week, and they had to help. So they quit school, and this was a big help to families because the boys got paid $1 a day. They did not keep the $30 a month, $25 went straight home to the parents.
That was a lot of money in 1933.
That was a lot of money. And they had $5 for spending money. But they had food, clothing, shelter, and medical care provided by the Army. And they signed up for a six-month period of time, and they could stay up to 2 years.
Now, you keep mentioning the boys, the so-called CCC boys. Who was exactly eligible for this?
The boys would have to be single and out of school, and they were from families that needed help. And they were boys, supposedly, you had to be 18 to 25, but there are quite a few boys who lied about their age. And one boy in New York State, he said, Marty, my father fell off a roof of the company, and he couldn't work anymore. So I went upstairs into my bedroom, got my birth certificate, and they had a thing called ink eradicator. It was sort of like peroxide, and he changed the date so that he was now 18 years old, but he was only 14 years old, and he signed up and worked in the battlefield, Saratoga, cleaning that up, and then went out to Utah. So they had to help their families.
Now, we're going to hear from some of these so-called CCC boys. West Hartford resident who's 102 years old. We'll hear from him in just a little bit. But I mentioned a little bit earlier about the idea that when you go to some of the state parks around the state, or even if you travel around the country, you may have seen the work of the CCC and not realized it. Tell us, as we go through the state of Connecticut, some of the places where they did their work.
Some of the places would be just right where I live in East Hampton, Salmon River. Then you could do the hiking in Portland, Meshamasick State Forest. Then if you go way up to the northwestern part, you've got Kent, Connecticut, Kent Falls. Then down toward Killingworth, you've got Chatfield Hollow State Park, which is gorgeous. That was one of the first parks that was built, and this is one of the places, too, we would like to raise money to create a statue to honor the work of the CCC boys. Then you go to up towards Union. They have state parks up there, and my brain is not working too well. Natchog River, too, Natchog State Forest, all these places for fishing and hiking.
So when you're at these state parks, you may be on a trail they helped create, or you'll see a building they helped build, or a bridge. Tell us a little bit more. You mentioned Chatfield Hollow. That's one of my favorite state parks in Killingworth. When you walk to the watermill, you can see a lot of the work that they did there.
And one of the biggest things they did was take this small stream going through this valley, and over about 2 years, they built this huge dam that holds back the water and created a beautiful swimming area and also fishing area and places for picnics along the banks. And there is also one building left, and it is a museum, a nature museum, right along the banks. And that's where we would like to erect the statue there. We have... Our goal is 24,000, and we're at about 9,000 now.
This is where we live. I'm speaking with Marty Podscotch, a historian, lives in East Hampton, and author of several books. His latest, Connecticut Civilian Conservation Corps Camps, the History, Memories, and Legacy of the CCC. They also planted a lot of trees, the CCC, around the country. You're mentioning the work here in Connecticut. There were 21 camps when the program started?
Yes, there were 21 camps total. And by the end of 1933, there were 15 camps throughout the state. And they, first of all, the boys lived in tents in July, and some of them even started before July 1st. So the boys lived in these army tents, and they would then hire local carpenters to build the approximately 15 buildings. You had five barracks. And each camp had 200 men in it, so you had about 40 boys in each barracks. And they also elected, a boy in that barracks that would be the leader. So he would get $45 a month, and he had to keep them in line, make sure the boys were up at 6 in the morning, the lights were out at 10, making sure, too, those barracks were clean as a whistle. And because if they weren't, when the army captain came, they would be in big trouble. They would not be able to go home maybe on a weekend pass or on Saturday night when they would take truckloads of boys down into the local town to see a movie or to a dance. They would not be able to go or get KP duty. Some of the boys, too, on that barracks, there were selected assistant leaders. They were paid $36. And that leader and assistant leader, their job was to keep the 38 boys in line. And some of the boys, too, they had other jobs, too. Some boys would just be typists, taking care of all those Army records, which are today stored in St. Louis. So any of the children of these CCC boys or relatives who would like to find out where was their dad or where was their uncle, they could be able to get it from St. Louis. And possibly maybe we could be able to put something on your website, how they could get their dad's records.
Now, were these camps integrated at the time?
Good question. When I did my book about the Adirondack Civilian Conservation Corps camps, I found that they were segregated. You had white camps, black camps, and there was one other camp, too, that was called veterans camps. But if I go back and tell you that Connecticut and New England was integrated, but you go down south, New York, Pennsylvania, and the rest of the South, they were segregated. When you went out west, like a lot of the boys from Connecticut, they needed workers. So one camp, quite a few of the camps in Colorado had 200 boys. They were all from Connecticut. They would go out there for 6 months. If they wanted, you know, another 6 months, they could sign up for a total of 2 years. And if I go back into that camp setting, think of those five barracks. Then there was an officer's building where they kept the records, etc. Then there would be a mess hall, which had connected to it the kitchen. So this is where the boys would have their breakfast. If they were working in the forest, the food was brought to them by truck, and then they came back. Then they would have their dinner, or supper, you call it, in that mess hall, and the boys would all be sitting, six boys to a picnic table, 200 boys, and they could have as much food as they wanted. Then there was also a clinic. So if a boy did get sick, each camp, if you could just imagine this, had an army doctor. Just like we have in schools, they have nurses. Mm-hmm. Well, they had an army doctor to take care of illnesses. And if they were really sick, like one of the people you're going to interview, he drove the ambulance, they would take to the nearest army hospital, which was Camp Wright on Fisher's Island. So Peter would drive his ambulance all the way to New London, put the boys on the ferry, and go to Fort Wright because they had an army hospital there.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. We're speaking with Marty Podskoch, an author of Connecticut Civilian Conservation Corps Camps, History, Memories, and Legacy of the CCC. We're going to learn more about the experiences of some of these CCC boys still living today, including a 102-year-old West Hartford resident. His story after the break. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Coming up later in the show, we'll learn about old Cherokee trails in North Carolina and efforts to map them. But right now, we're talking about the CCC. There were 21 Civilian Conservation Corps camps in Connecticut during the Great Depression. Nearly 3 million young men joined the Corps nationwide, learning vital skills while helping support their families. East Hampton, Connecticut resident Marty Podskoch researched the stories of the men from our state who worked in the CCC. He's in the studio with us today to talk about his latest book, Connecticut Civilian Conservation Corps Camps, History, Memories, and Legacy of the CCC. But first, some of those so-called CCC boys are still alive today. Where We Live producer Jeff Tyson went to the home of Michael Popovich to hear about his experience working in the CCC in 1933. Popovich is 102 years old now and lives in West Hartford. Here's his interview.
Questions and answers. You can ask me a question, I'll see if I can answer.
Let's do that. So take me back to your teen years. And
yeah.
You were born in Waterbury, is that
Yes, right? That's right. I was born in Waterbury.
What was your hometown like? And tell me about your family.
Oh, the family. Oh, we had five sisters, one brother, and myself. I was the older one. We all chipped in together to make the house run. It was a five-acre plot, which we owed quite a bit of money on it. And, of course, we did all our vegetables and fruit and all that sort of stuff just to survive. But, I mean, there was a lot of other people doing the same thing, so we were kind of everybody in the same category.
And then during the Depression, how did that affect your family?
That's it. Right, yeah. Well, I was just about old enough to get a job, but couldn't get in. And my dad couldn't get a job either. Well, he worked there for a while, and then they laid off. then going into the WPA. I remember working one day for him because he didn't feel good. But anyway, he got a job later on after I got into CCC.
Yeah. So when did you find out about the CCC? Was it through your father?
Through my father, yeah. Apparently he knew about it. Yeah, and like I say, he must have talked to some of the other, because some of the boys also went. I don't remember their name, but we all started in Waterbury, then went to New Haven, then back to New London, and that's where it all started from there.
Yeah, and this was your first time away from home?
Pardon?
Was this your first time away from home?
That's right, first time away from home. First time I saw a real ocean, too. So it was quite a rig. I don't know what happened to me. Picked out me. I was supposed to distribute all the Army shoes. This was all World War One Army stuff. Yeah. Clothes, shirts, jackets, shoes, stockings, and even a campaign hat.
Really?
Yeah, that was a stupid thing. It looked like a dish upside down. But anyway, about a week or so later, we got on the old Liberty truck. Oh, geez, I'll never forget that. It had solid rubber tires, and we drove that. Some guy drove it all the way from New London all the way up to Danbury, and that's where the camp was. It's adjacent to Squants Pond.
Okay.
And we got there. It was all Army stuff, so we had to put up tents, eight people to a tent.
Did you know how to put up a tent that first time?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, we didn't know that. It was a squad tent, they call it. Eight people were in it, and got all that together, and of course, it was all no houses around or anything, but we made out all right until the rains came. Then it was a problem. Because we were on the side of a hill, and the rain would come down and in between your cot. Oh yeah, everything was cots and blankets and everything, and we had little tricks we used to play by poking a stick in the hole in the ground and diverting the water to the next guy instead of coming down your way. Yeah, but we had a lot of little jokes that we'd play on each other.
Yeah. And tell me about the other boys that you were they from all over?
Oh,
were they
oh, yeah,
all
they,
walks of life?
They were all over Connecticut, from Connecticut, yeah. But I don't remember any of their names or where they were from. But I do remember one guy there. At night, he snored like a son of a gun. So what we did is, in the middle of the night, he picked up the cot and put him right next to the Squants Pond. So if he jumped off of it, he would right go into the pond. But I thought that was a dirty trick, but it worked.
And so what was your day-to-day like? What was your schedule?
Day-to-day. Yeah, of course, you woke up with Reveille. The guy had a whole trumpet there. And we got up and had a breakfast, which was made by a cook there. And, of course, we washed our own mess kits and canteens. They were also Army issue. And after that, we went to work. The area where we were must have been a forest fire about 10 years before. And this whole idea was reforestation. So we had to go up along the trail. There's some trails that were made previously, or if there wasn't any, we'd make them. And we'd cut the woods away, make a trail, and then clear 10 feet on each side of the trail of bushes or anything like that. And we had our job was to get rid of it and burn it or whatever. Yeah, mostly burned, yeah. And if there was a big stone in the way, we'd have to move that. And if it was very big, we'd actually have to drill a hole and blast it into smaller pieces. Wow. And
so you learned how to use dynamite, that right?
That's right. We used to, dynamite and what do you call it? Drill a stone by hand. And I was lucky. I I don't know how I got it, but we had a small jackhammer, which was handy. Or sometimes we just used dynamite, put it underneath the stone, and we used to call it a mud pack, and put mud all around it, and then hide someplace, let it off, and blast it off, and it would roll into the Squanch Pond, you know, from the hill.
Yeah.
And that was an easy job. But most of the work was cutting branches down and burning them and smoothing out the a real path for a truck to go by, or a fire truck, but if you want to call it.
These skills that you were learning, the jobs that you had,
yes,
were these were all new skills for you back home?
Yeah, never knew it, never did it before.
Yeah.
No, a lot of people got hurt because of it.
You know,
cut with an axe, chopping trees down or something like that, or shovels and picks and all that regular construction work during the old ages. No, we didn't have any tractor or anything like that.
Did you have some training before, or were you sort of thrown into the work?
I was too young for that, yeah, no. Well, just on a farm,
yeah.
You always pick and shovel there also.
Did the Army train you, though, when they brought you to the camp? Did they spend some time teaching you, or they threw you into the job?
You go right into the job, yeah. No training.
Yeah.
They just give you a lot of ideas how to keep safe. That's about it. Mm-hmm. But some of the stuff there was nice. I mean, the beautiful weather and everything like that.
You mentioned that this was sort of a sad state of affairs for you. When you look back on this time, do you think that...
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of sad because you were away from home. This is the first time I was ever away from home. And you get kind of lonely by yourself there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you do on the weekends?
Pardon?
What did you do on the weekends or in the evenings?
Oh, sing a lot. Sing a lot. Play. There was a fellow that had a banjo or a ukulele or something, but we sang a lot and play cards, a lot of cards playing, and baseball. They had baseball out there. There was a lot of land there in the park, and that was about it. Swimming, we did a lot of swimming in there. Of course, right next to, right on the pond itself. Oh, yeah, 1 month, I can't remember, they had I don't know if they still have it, the Danbury Fair. We went to the Danbury Fair, the whole bunch of us walked it from the camp to the fair, which is 10 miles one way. That's how big the Candlewood Lake is, yeah, which is man-made. And we had a lot of fun there. Not many people spent money because they didn't have any.
Right.
But it was a nice time.
When you look back at your time in the CCC and when you think about the CCC as a whole, program, President Roosevelt started it.
Yes,
do you think it was a good thing for the country?
Absolutely. It put a lot of people into little jobs. And I think, like I say, a lot of them just the first time out from home. And I think it was very educational. No, I wouldn't say profitable, because at the end of the week or the month, they'd give you $5. The rest would go to your parents.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a heartbreaker. But, you didn't spend too much money. I don't know. It's no one to spend it on.
So you were doing it for your families.
That's right. Absolutely. Yes, yes.
Yeah.
I remember after I got discharged, there was no way to get home. So I had a chisel ride all the way from Danbury to Waterbury.
You hitched a ride, you said?
You hitched a ride, yeah. And that was quite a thing there. Okay. And with Army clothes, a lot of people didn't know where you were.
I know that the CCC doesn't exist anymore, but I know a lot of people advocate that the government or various states should have these sorts of programs again.
You know what? That would be a good idea, I think, because it would take a lot of people, teenagers especially, off the street, and jobs that would be helpful for later on, because you learn a lot, not only that, how to do it, how to mix with people, and that means quite a bit.
This is Where We Live. You just heard an interview with 102-year-old Michael Popovich of West Hartford. He sat down with Where We Live producer Jeff Tyson to talk about his days working in the Civilian Conservation Corps 84 years ago. Do you remember stories from family members who worked in the CCC? Have you noticed their work at local state parks? Join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You just heard from also Marty Podscotch. He's an author of the book Connecticut Civilian Conservation Corps Camps, History, Memories, and Legacy of the CCC. You were smiling a lot while we were listening to the interview with 102-year-old Michael Popovich. What stands out to you about his story? And you've interviewed lots of these so-called CCC boys.
What stands out is that he still remembers all of these things that has happened to him. He's 102 years old. And the other boys, too, these stories about how they helped their families. Unbelievable how they had to quit school. And many of them went straight into World War II. They were prepared by the Army. They knew how to make their beds. They knew how to take orders. They were also leaders, too. Many of these boys who, when they went into World War II, became sergeants if they were leaders. So those were the big things. And as Michael said, I learned how to get along with each other. They learned skills. They learned surveying, driving trucks, so many different skills, or running the office, keeping track of the records, or being a cook in the mess hall. Many of these boys were sent to Army camps, big camps, maybe Fort Dix or to Fort Wright, and were taught how to cook for 200 men three times a day.
I mentioned earlier there were 21 of these CCC camps in Connecticut, but there was one exclusively for veterans?
Yes. The Niantic Camp in 1933 was a veterans camp. Well, it turned out when Hoover was president in 1932, the veterans of World War I were promised a bonus. It was supposed to come in 1940 approximately. But when the Depression hit, these veterans didn't have jobs. So they marched on Washington, and they asked President Hoover and Congress, please give us our bonus now. We need it. They had their tents set up. They marched, just like we have marchers today in Washington. And Hoover sent General MacArthur, drove them out, shot at them. Some men were even shot and killed. They burned their tents. So the following year, 33, they said, hey, we got a new president. So they marched again. And who do you think Roosevelt sent? Mm-hmm. Eisenhower? No, it was Eleanor. Eleanor drove in her limousine there, sat down and talked to the boys. Now, what is the problem? Well, my husband doesn't want any problems, wants to help you out. So he started camps throughout the United States that were just for veterans of World War I and also Spanish-American War. So the one at Niantic was started out as a veterans camp. Later on, the one at Mohawk State Forest, too, in 38, got the veterans that were up there working on the Winooski Dam. Mm-hmm. They came down and then worked there at that camp.
How many of these CCC boys are around today?
To my knowledge, in Connecticut, there are seven that I know that I interviewed for my book. But there are other people. One of the guys, Gary Potter from Bristol, he just sent me a clipping of a man from Bristol, just died in June. He was also a CCC boy. So mm-hmm. I've given, you know, probably 100 talks throughout the state. But there's still boys that are still alive mm-hmm. that, you know, have stories to tell, and I wish I could be able to gather those stories. And many of the children whose fathers worked in the CCC just would love to know where their father was. Jody Rell, when I was at the CCC Museum in Stafford Springs, she said, Marty, if I only asked my father what he did, she said he did something in Virginia or North Carolina. So I gave her the directions how to call up the Army place there in St. Louis.
This is an extensive book that you've written. Again, Marty Potscotch here on Where We Live. His latest book, Connecticut Civilian Conservation Corps Camps, History, Memories, and Legacy of the CCC. We heard a little bit from Michael Popovich. Tell us about another CCC boy, Joe Arnold.
Joe Arnold has an unbelievable story. His father and mother, they had a house in outside of New York City. It was the home of the guy who wrote Trees. I think that I shall never see a poem as lovely as a tree. And he had a great roofing business. Then the Depression hit. Joe Arnold's father lost everything. He took the five children and his wife to Connecticut, and he just could not cope with this. He left his family, and Joe was a ninth grader. He said, Marty, I had to quit school. So he quit school, got a job working at the Housatonic Meadows in Sharon, Connecticut. And after 6 months, he signed up for Colorado. A lot of these boys, oh boy, to go out west. So he signed up and he stayed there for a year and a half. And every end of 6 months, they had a week off. So he'd say, hey, his buddy would say, Joe, let's go down to Mexico. So they went down to the Grand Junction Railroad Terminal there and looked at the boxcars. Oh, this one's going to Mexico. So they would hop on and go to Mexico, come back after 6 months. His buddy would say, hey, Joe, let's go to San Francisco. So you could just imagine Joe and his buddy sitting on a boxcar going over the Rocky Mountains into San Francisco, seeing this fantastic city, and then losing his buddy. And then coming back to get back time so they wouldn't be AWOL. So, oh, then he came back after the war. He wanted to get his GED. So he took a test, and Joe said, well, what do I have to do now to get my high school diploma? And she said, Joe, you're not going to get your high school diploma. You're going to college. And he went to the beginning college of New Haven College, studied engineering. Later on, he became the head of the department. And the rags to riches stories, and all because the CCC had a great influence on him.
And that was a theme that you heard time and time again. Not only were these young boys learning valuable skills outdoors, they were able to send money home to family, they had food to eat, but it led them on a successful course later in life.
Right. They were able to, another great guy too, was this poor boy from Norwich. He went to Stafford Springs, and then he went to World War II, got a degree with the GI Bill, went to Philadelphia to work, came back to Norwich, and he founded Mohegan Sun. So
this was Ralph Sturgis?
Ralph Sturgis, yes. And I got his story there in 2007. He was at a reunion at the Stafford Springs Museum, one of the best museums in the whole United States. And he said, got his story, and he said, Marty, come down to the my office. I'll show you all the carvings I've done in marble. Then found out he had passed away. But I did, was lucky to get his story down.
We just have a few more minutes left, but I wanted to ask, the Civilian Conservation Corps ended around 1942. What were the efforts through the years to bring back this kind of program?
There have been efforts just here in Connecticut during the 80s. One of the programs was the YCCs, and I've met a few boys and girls who through at high school, they worked in our state parks, building picnic tables, doing trail work, etc. Then I went to Missoula, Montana. I met the Montana CCCs. These are young boys and girls who work for about 7 or 8 months, and then they get a stipend and plus a place to stay, and they do work on our state parks and national parks. California also has it. So when Jody Urell was governor, she heard about this. She said, I'm going to try it. I think she had about 20 kids for one summer, boys and girls, working in the state parks. But because of budget cuts, etc. Just like our beautiful museum there in Stafford Spring has been sort of closed. It's open. If anybody who would be interested in going to it, they could call the DEEP and they will open it on special occasions.
We just got a Facebook message from a listener who writes, Donald writes, my father worked on the Merritt Parkway in Fairfield Hills Hospital during the 30s with the Civilian Conservation Corps. So a lot of people have a connection to this, again, this jobs relief program back during the time of Roosevelt and the Great Depression. I wanted to thank Marty Podscotch, a historian and author of Connecticut Civilian Conservation Corps Camps, the History, Memories, and Legacy of the CCC. You brought a lot of memorabilia with you. We've taken pictures. We're going to post that on our website. But if someone was listening and they wanted to help get their story, their grandfather's story to you, how could they contact you?
They could do it two ways. They could call me, 860-267-2442, or by email, my last name, Podscotch, P-O-D-S-K-O-C-H, at comcast.net.
I should ask before we go, any family connection to the CCC?
None at all. It was just, I just love gathering these stories. As I said, I went from fire towers mm-hmm. to the CCC, and now I'm in Rhode Island. If anybody has any parents or family members in Rhode Island, I'm doing that. And I'm also gathering information for a book about traveling to all the 169 towns of Connecticut.
Well, you certainly keep busy. We'd love to have you back on. Thank you so much again, Marty Podscotch.
Great to be here. Thanks.
This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up next, we hear about efforts to learn about Native American trails that still survive in the woods today. That's after the break. And we want to hear from you, too. Email wherewelive at WMPR.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchil. Coming up Monday, during World War II, the Nazis experimented on Polish women at a concentration camp outside of Berlin. After the war, socialite and Connecticut resident Caroline Faraday helped bring dozens of these women to the U.S. for medical treatment. On the next Where We Live, we'll talk with the author of Lilac Girls, a novel based on Faraday, and we'll learn more about Faraday's home and landmark in Bethlehem, Connecticut. Join us. That's coming up on Monday. But first, as you walk through local woods, did you ever think about the trails or paths that existed long before the settlers came to North America? There are efforts to recognize and map the trails of Native American tribes. Our next two guests know quite a bit about them. They're both North Carolina residents. First, joining us by phone is Lamar Marshall, Resource Director for Southeast Heritage. It's a group dedicated to reconstructing historical landscapes. Lamar, welcome to the show.
I'm pleased to be here.
Also on the phone with us is Dr. Brett Riggs, a research archaeologist and Sequoia Distinguished Professor of Cherokee Studies at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Dr. Riggs, welcome to the show.
Hello. Glad to be here.
I understand that Lamar's walked a lot of these trails, but Dr. Briggs over at Western Carolina University, you've studied these trails, also the Eastern Band of the Cherokee Nation for some time. Tell us about the trails and how they were developed.
Well, if you think about the trail system or this whole matrix, this network that cross-cut the entire continent, many of these were founded upon what had initially been the animal paths that took the routes of least resistance across the landscape. And when the first peoples entered this continent, they already found established routes used by what they would view as game animals that interlinked the entire area. And so many of the oldest trails that Native peoples used were already in place when they arrived and found them. And Native peoples, particularly Cherokee folks here in the mountains, often thought of these trails as being an integral part of the landscape, not necessarily even of a cultural construction, but something that was an inherent and implicit part of this landscape, such that everything was viewed as being held together by paths. Even the routes that fish in the water took, they followed certain trails. Everything was conceptualized in terms of trails, so that even in a broader sense, you know, if you look at the construction of the native cosmos, the upper world, the world above, is linked by trails. The Milky Way is a trail. So these trails were seen as being a very natural part of the landscape and a very important part of the landscape to native peoples.
Now, Lamar, also on the phone with us, you've been surveying these trails for some time, walking many of them. How did this start for you?
Well, I guess about 50 years ago, I started really studying the old maps, records, and journals so I could produce modern maps with the old trails and trail corridors, Native American towns and settlements. But when I was very young, I was very fascinated with the lifestyle of Native Americans because I could see, you know, we grew up in a corporate world and structured, and you have to go to work every day. And the Native Americans seemed to be one of the freest peoples on Earth before they became involved in trade with other with the Europeans.
Dr. Riggs was talking about how these trails and the meaning of the trails in Native American culture. But when you're looking and going into the woods to try to find some of these old trails, are many of them covered up now? I mean, we look at our modern transportation system, some of the roads in our states may have followed these trails as well?
Absolutely. I would say that there's very few intact premier segments of the trails left. Where you find your best examples, if they're still around, are on national forest, on public lands, because they have obviously not been developed and they were kind of set aside. But the native trails, I'd call it the blueprint or the circuitry of our modern road system, because you'd have an animal trail, it became a Cherokee trail, and then the first white settlers would come in and they would widen these trails into wagon roads or turnpikes, and then later on they got paved and et cetera. So it's an ancient road system that's been here for a long, long time.
This is where we live. Today we're looking at efforts to find old Native American trails and map them. On the phone with us is Lamar Marshall, Resource Director for Southeast Heritage and a North Carolina resident. He's walking a lot of these trails, helping to find them, old Cherokee trails in western North Carolina. Also on the phone, Dr. Brett Riggs, a Sequoia Distinguished Professor of Cherokee Studies at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Dr. Riggs, how are you working with Lamar as he's finding these trails, comparing old maps and working with what he's finding on the ground? What are you doing in terms of helping him with this project?
Well, we work with many of the same resources. I'm primarily involved in documentation efforts for the Trail of Tears National Historic Trail. And in western North Carolina, we have a remarkable sets of documentation that assist us in that effort. So I'm focused on landscape reconstruction for a moment in time, whereas Lamar has a much broader view there. But the work that we do, each informs the other in terms of our understanding of the landscape, because the landscape that existed in the 1830s at the time of the forced Cherokee deportation from the southern mountains is, of course, a landscape that has developed for millennia. And Lamar's work helps to bring into focus the entire transportation network that was then used and exploited at the time of the Cherokee removal.
And how are you both working with members of the Cherokee tribe? What is their reaction to this project, again, mapping out these old trails, land that was once theirs that was taken away?
Well, I think what we see is that the lands for particularly the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, a federally recognized tribe here in the southern Appalachians, that their world, their landscape, has been so circumscribed historically through the 19th century and into the 20th centuries, that what our efforts accomplish is to give folks sort of access to their historical landscapes again, so to create at least a cognitive reclaiming of this landscape as theirs, this place that was theirs for hundreds and thousands of years.
And Lamar Marshall, again, your resource director for Southeast Heritage, I believe some of the members of this group are also members of the Cherokee tribe. Their reaction to your work and how they're contributing to it?
Well, I'd say that the last 8 years I've been funded by the Cherokee Eastern Band through their Cherokee Preservation Foundation. And Brett Riggs and I both are involved in their GIS program. So what I'm doing is taking 8 years of work and building story maps that be online that can be used by teachers, by anybody in the tribe, and other people also, where they can have a graphic, interactive map. And, well, let's put it this way. You get online, and there's a story, say, of a Cherokee territorial claim, 1700, in the ecology. These story maps have a panel on one side, and you can have videos, images, graphics, connections to other sites. And then the bigger part of the screen has a map that is interactive. You can zoom in, and there's the Cherokee trails, there's the towns, and they can actually get in there and you know, move around. This is an incredible resource.
And I'd asked this earlier, Lamar, about the process, and you said that you compare a lot of the old maps. When you're out in the woods, are you literally drawing what you're seeing in journals? And how do you translate all that you're discovering to then work with Dr. Riggs in this digital mapping project?
Well, as a background in surveying, I carry a field book with me and a GPS, of course. But first of all, you have to determine where a trail might be or might not be. I use historic maps from before 1700 to present. We dig out early surveys where they actually went out and surveyed the tracts of land, and it says cross the Indian Trail at this point. And you got two different systems of the meets and bounds in North Carolina, but in Alabama, where I worked, the land is in sections, townships, and ranges, and the surveyors were meticulous sometimes to detail where a trail crossed. I dig out oral testimonies and chronicles. And one of the most valuable things is to find diaries and journals, particularly some of the military journals, that document mile by mile exactly, like in 1761, 1776, where they traveled and describe the landscape. Mm-hmm. And so I take all of this, determine where a trail might be, and if it goes down a valley, I start on the ridgetop, and I'll transect from one ridgetop to the other to see if I can find an original trail in the bottom. In many cases, they've been destroyed by logging operations. So it's when you find a premier section, it's a big find. And then, of course, GPS it, come back and put it into GIS and document it.
Mm. Sounds like really extensive work. Anything like this being done in other parts of the country, Dr. Riggs?
There is, in fact, really all across our country, many efforts that are sponsored by the U.S. Forest Service and the National Park Service to document at least some of the more important transportation routes across the country. For instance, the National Park Service has a long-distance trails office that manages historic trailways across the country. So you see El Camino Real, the Santa Fe Trail, and various routes like that that are important to our history as a nation. And I think Lamar and I would assert that these native trails that predate the European arrival are equally important to the history and heritage of our nation.
After you turn in the data to the Cherokee Nation, what's next for you, Lamar? I know you're a conservationist.
Well, I'm going to continue my historical research and continue the same work because in the last 8 years I've got over 100,000 digital images of archives, historic maps, and maybe I'll write some e-books or something.
Well, I want to thank Lamar Marshall, Resource Director for Southeast Heritage. He lives in North Carolina, and we appreciate your time talking about the work you're doing, Lamar. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Also, Dr. Brett Riggs, Lamar's working with him to digitize these maps. Again, the data will be given over to the Cherokee Nation. Dr. Brett Riggs, Sequoia Distinguished Professor of Cherokee Studies at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee, North Carolina. Dr. Riggs, very important work. Thank you so much for telling us a little bit about it.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Our show is produced by Lydia Brown and Jeff Tyson. Our technical producer is Kion Wolf. WNPR's executive producer is Katie Tolarski. Check out wnpr.org/where we live for more about the show. I'm Lucy Nalpathanchel. Thanks for listening.